Net-a-Porter presents The Incredible Women Podcast, Series 8, The Powerhouses.
Welcome to the new series of The Incredible Women Podcast in partnership with De Beers, in which we sit down with women who are leading the charge in their industries, those who are admired for their unique talent, strength, drive and influence. All at the top of their game, some of these incredible women you'll already be familiar with, and others we're excited to introduce you to. I'm Alice Casely-Hayford, Content Director at Net-a-Porter, and I'm thrilled to be joined for this episode of our Powerhouses series by actor, writer, producer, founder, and CEO, Issa Rae.
Power can be defined so many ways. I think recognizing my own personal power to make decisions, to take stands, to influence has been quite a journey, but also recognizing the power that I don't have and trying to circumvent that.
Born in LA in 1985, Rae was destined to become part of the fabric of Hollywood. After spending some of her childhood in Senegal, her father's country of origin, Rae returned to LA and began acting during high school. In 2007, Rae graduated from Stanford University with a Bachelor of Arts in African and African American Studies, and just a few years later, made her first major mark on the industry with her award-winning web series and the accompanying New York Times bestseller, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. In 2020, Rae formed Hooray, a multifaceted media company that develops content across mediums to continue to break boundaries in storytelling and representation. And in 2021, Hooray signed a five-year film and television deal with WarnerMedia. Rae is perhaps most loved for creating and starring in the HBO series Insecure, which garnered her multiple Emmy and Golden Globe nominations. Last year, Rae played President Barbie in the box office smash hit from Greta Gerwig, as well as having roles in Spider-Man in the Spider-Verse, and most recently, the award-winning American Fiction. Let's meet Issa.
Well, hello, Issa. Welcome. It is such a pleasure to be speaking with you today on our podcast. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here.
Good. Well, we are so, so happy to have you. And I think we couldn't really not begin with Barbie, which has been one of the biggest moments of the past 12 months. And of course, you were central in that as President Barbie. How did that casting happen?
She was the Barbie that was assigned to me, and I was honored. You know, Greta Gerwig, we got on a Zoom, and she so nicely said that, you know, she, when she imagines a world, it makes her happy to think of me as president. And I was that's that is absolutely absurd. But I was honored, like, that in this world, she thought of me as the Barbie president, this world that she painted as perfect, albeit flawed, but still, I was excited to be a part of the world. And I've been wanting to work with her, such a fan of hers, and obviously love Margot. And it was just a dream job, honestly.
You said that the Barbie dance sequence was the worst day of your life.
Yes.
Why, pray tell?
Well, that was the only pressure cooker scenario, because it was this big dance number, the only dance number for the Barbies, and I didn't have time to learn it. I learned that the president was going to have to be a part of the dance number the day before I was supposed to fly to London.
Oh, God.
And then learned also that it would be the first thing that I'd shoot. So I'm not a dancer. I'm not good at dancing. I've always, like, since my Awkward Black Girl days, like, I dedicated an episode to not being able to dance. They sent me a video to learn it, and I tried my best to do that. And then when I landed, they changed the dance. So they were like, we're actually going to have it. We're going to, once you land at your hotel, we're going to drive you and have you learn the new dance so you could do it tomorrow. So I had to spend 24 hours learning the dance and then messing up in front of everybody. But Greta's so like, this is just like dancing in your bedroom. It's just fun. And don't, it's no pressure. And I'm like, sure, you can say that. And you love dance. But this is, it is my worst nightmare. It's my worst fear. It's, to me, it was like the equivalent of showing up naked to set. Because you're just like, here I am and all my flaws. Oh. And you're seeing it the first day. I don't even get to lead with what I feel confident in.
But I guess then the only way is up from that point.
That is exactly correct. I was like, once I got that out the way, I was like, whew, it felt like a weight lifted off my shoulders. I was like, oh, I could do anything now. So.
And so you should as President Barbie. But, you've been a part of some great ensemble casts of late, but that was like, whoa, what a mega lineup. Can you tell us a little bit more about being on set with those other megastars?
Yes, and I'm glad you said that. Like, I made a goal at the beginning of the year, maybe the end of that previous year, that I wanted to be in more ensemble works, you know, after working with BJ Novak on Vengeance. And that was like, you know, a minor world, but I got to be up close and watch him direct and be a part of an amazing cast. And I was like, I like this. There's an opportunity to kind of learn from like speed date actors that yeah. I want to work with and talent that I want to work with. So I don't need to lead everything. I want to be a part of something bigger and great and like a essential puzzle piece. And in that way, I'm connected to these other greats. And so Barbie was the perfect example of that, being able to work with phenomenal director. That cast was incredible, not only because it had like established greats like Ryan Gosling and Will Ferrell and Rhea Perlman, but it also had so much up and coming talent that I got to get to know too. I don't think Alexandra Shipp is up and coming. She's been working a lot, but like having a relationship with her, Scott Evans, Shruti, like that was such a rich exercise in bonding that like, really, I treasure so much. And even, you know, we keep in touch now, and especially around all the Barbie press and some of the snubs. but it's been such an enriching experience with that, and even American Fiction and Spider-Verse to a degree. Like those have really filled me in many different ways.
Well, it's really interesting to hear you saying that it was an active decision for you to be more a part of ensemble projects, because from the get-go, you've been leading, you've been embedded, you've been creating and starring. And, you know, it must have been incredibly overwhelming having such a multifaceted yes. career and being a part of projects on every level. So it must be nice, not that you're putting your feet up but now by any means. But
no, you're right. You hit the nail on the head. I realized I just kind of dove in head first and was just like, I'm in this world and there's so much that I needed to learn and was expected to know. And there's so much that I didn't know. So this gave me an opportunity to learn so much behind the scenes and in front of the camera with less pressure, for sure. Mm-hmm.
So obviously you've been in three of the most talked about, buzziest films of the year, Barbie, Spider-Verse and American Fiction. All, which I hasten to add, were nominated for Oscars, which is phenomenal. What does it feel like to be part of three such amazing projects that were all so different as well?
Incredible. And it didn't really dawn on me until, you know, other representation were texting me like, oh, congratulations, three movies that were Oscar nominated. And then I got another text from one of the producers of American Fiction. And he was like, all three movies you did last year got nominated. And yeah. putting it like that was like, oh, that's like a great batting average.
To say the least.
Obviously, like, you know, I played a small part in each of them. But the goal was to be a part of these incredible projects with these incredible talents. And I'm happy that the Academy and other bodies have recognized that these are such great films. And I appreciated each experience individually. They were, like you said, so different from Spider-Verse, where it was so intimate. And I showed up like this in sweats in a studio, working directly with the directors, occasionally working with an actor, to American Fiction, which was indie, smaller budget, first-time director with the inimitable Jeffrey Wright, you know, and it was just like, oh, wow, this is filmmaking. And then, of course, this grand scale, high budget project that was Barbie that shot in London. They were just such great, vastly different experiences.
And I love them all. But let's talk about American Fiction, because that blew my mind. It was sensational from start to finish. As you mentioned, the cast, phenomenal performances, but then also not only those characters that you love, but those characters that you love to hate. exquisite writing. I could go on without sounding too much like a sycophant, but it was just brilliant.
Thank you.
But it must have been really interesting, I guess, to be satirizing an industry that you're kind of a part of, and also seeing characters that you must have encountered a lot, unfortunately, throughout your career coming up. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, when I was cast, I was definitely giving the side eye to Cord. Like, do you think that I'm a centaur? Are you trying to say that? Am I the centaur to your monk? But then, you know, like, the script is so incredible and you just got it right away. I was engrossed and recognized that I have been a monk, where you're desperate to break in and be acknowledged for your work, and you're seeing what's recognized around you, especially by white critics. And you're like, do I need white validation to succeed? And how am I also contributing to that just by what I support and what I don't support? And like, what do I need to do to, do I need to adapt to break in? Do I need to play the game to break in? And it put me in such an angry, negative place until I did get the opportunity. And then I found myself to be other people's centaurs, you know, like, and that's part of even the anybody's ascent. You know, people will root for you when you're coming up. And then once you become more established, you get picked apart. Then you become kind of part of the system and part of what's heralded. And so I had to adjust to that. And I stand by the conversation that they have at the end. It was such a rich debate. And I find that there's value in creating what the market wants, as long as it's with a sense of integrity, as opposed to what I even see now in the industry, where it's just like, y'all are just making things based off of an algorithm. There's no passion, there's no artistry to anything that you're putting out, and people see through it. That's why it's not successful. And it's such a, I don't know, energy suck, inspiration suck of just like, wow, are we even acknowledging what ingenues and creatives are actually trying to do? Are we rewarding them in any way? Are we taking any risks?
Mm. I think it's going to make a lot of people squirm naturally, but it's also going to open up a lot of conversations. And even when I was in the cinema, some of my people around me were like dying a death and I was just laughing harder. But I think, yeah, it's just been fantastic to see the response and nominations flooding in. And I'm just delighted, because sometimes Hollywood can reject these sorts of things that are looking at it too closely. So that's been a phenomenal thing to see. Do you think we are in a position that we're moving further away from a very monolithic representation of blackness that's just about the ghetto or this, that and the other? I think thanks to amazing artists like you, who are creating far more diverse representation of who we are as black people. But in terms of Hollywood more broadly, is it open to that or not yet?
I think there was a specific time that we're kind of coming out of, or yes, like Hollywood is open to like all these stories about different types of black people. And we were just getting started. And now I feel like they're like turning off the faucet, like, okay, that's enough. You know, now we got to go broad again. We're trying to make money. And the niche thing was cool and appealing to specific audiences was a time, but now we got to go broad. We got to make Wall Street happy. And, you know, the strike, of course, played a part in the decrease in output, and in that decrease in output comes just more limitations about what Hollywood is willing to make, limitations on, I would say, and that applies to works of color. And so because less things will be made, there will be less opportunities. And then, I don't know, maybe we will go back to this monolithic representation of blackness, but the optimist in me is just like, we can't go backwards. People are tired. We've seen, you know, what's possible. And because there are voices on social media, like, there's outcries and there's criticism and there are things that people can voice that they're not seeing. And I know that executives are watching and listening. So, and that's also why it's essential for us, like people who have these opportunities to uplift other voices, you know, otherwise we'll have nothing and we won't have these other opportunities to showcase the range of Blackness.
Totally. So what are the stories that you want to see told and that you want to tell in 2024 and beyond?
I'll start with the stories I want to see, not necessarily produce, but like I just got this amazing opportunity to go to Senegal to discover like my history. And just even on that journey, the hearing about the kingdoms that existed in Senegal in particular, but just knowing what existed in Africa, like an African Game of Thrones would eat so badly. And I want that. I want that so much. And I want to see more diasporic representation of Blackness that isn't just relegated to certain regions. Because I know like the UK has, I know that it's limited over there, but like there's still specific representations of Caribbean Blackness and African Blackness. And even a show like Riches, which got canceled on Amazon, I was like, it was so great to see a setting like that and to see different types of Blackness. And those are stories that I'm interested in seeing and maybe helping to produce, to tell. And then I just have my own, like there's certain on the genre side that we haven't really gotten a chance to flex our muscles. I think Get Out inspired a bunch of other creatives to make social horror. But I'm like, there's also just like regular horror, like Black people in just scary situations that don't necessarily have to have a message. Like we can do those too. And yeah, I love a good drama. You know, I love a good family drama. And I feel like OWN with Queen Sugar was able to do that, but I don't think it received the respect that it should have. But I also like soapy things. So like I want messy Black family, like Dallas type dramas.
Oh, yes, exactly. That would be epic. This series is called The Powerhouses. What have you learned throughout your very prolific, incredible career about power?
My goodness, that power can be defined so many ways. I think recognizing my own personal power to make decisions, to take stands, mm-hmm. to influence has been quite a journey, but also recognizing the power that I don't have mm-hmm. and trying to circumvent that. One of my mantras this year is to build more doors because that's how I kind of broke in. It's building doors when I felt like I didn't have the power to break into the industry. And so keeping that mentality of, you know, you don't have to always take no for an answer. There's always another way.
Mm. I'd love to hear more about not taking no for an answer because it's something that I struggle with. And obviously, as a fellow Black woman, I'm very, very aware of the trope of the angry Black woman. And as a leader and a manager, I sometimes feel I have to overcompensate in asserting myself in the right way so that I'm not perceived in the wrong way. Is that Absolutely. Something that you experience and how do you navigate that?
Absolutely. I was just having a conversation with friends about that. I still overcompensate and not taking no for an answer. I just want to be clear. I'm not delusional. Like I know when something isn't working, yeah. then it doesn't work. But when I believe in something and I feel like, oh, we haven't exhausted all possibilities mm-hmm. here and I find that there's a route, then I will pursue it. And to your point, I will attempt to pursue it with grace. I'm never hard on anybody because I am aware of that perception, but also like, that's just not my personality. So it's like, I would say that I'm a gentle nudger, but in the past, even when I've been upset about something and expressed it, I felt bad. Like, oh, I hope I didn't hurt this person's feelings or, oh, I'm like, now there's tension and living in that feels gross. And I've had to tell myself, you're just setting expectations and this is part of it. And even in my own personal journey, when I've received constructive criticism, if it's valid, you know, I I followed that critique, and it might sting a little at first. But that's just an ego thing. So I'm like, we're constantly, especially in this industry, massaging people's egos. And when you take that out of the equation, we're all just trying to be better and do our best. And that's the standpoint that I operate from.
Talking a bit about egos and talking more about yourself and confidence and self-belief, where is that rooted on? You have many strings to your brilliant bow, but how, when you're maybe exploring a slightly different avenue or venturing into something new, where is that self-belief rooted in?
The self-belief is just rooted in the fact that I know what I bring to the table. I know that I'm a hard worker. I know that, you know, I'm intelligent. I don't know everything. And I also lead with that. So there's a humility in the approach. There always will be. And because of that, I feel confident approaching anything. I think the insecurities come when you pretend, and I don't pretend much. So my confidence comes with just like some of the vulnerabilities are going to be on my sleeve and you're going to see them, but you're also going to know what I know. And I feel confident projecting that.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. You spoke on another podcast about being more intentional, not only in the projects that you're choosing, but also in your time off and your vacations. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And are you very busy for the rest of 2024? Or are you trying to preserve your time and be a bit more precious with it?
Well, this year is very interesting because, you know, the strike, this was the first time where I was like, oh my God, I don't have any projects on my calendar. This is the first time that's happened in 10 years. So I don't know what my year looks like. And there's an exhilaration behind that where I'm just like, ooh, I'm kind of crafting my own destiny in a different way where I'm just like, oh, now I have to really put pen to paper and make things happen while also waiting. Like, oh, I wonder what's going to come my way, if anything. And I'm scared. What if nothing comes my way? So there's a balance. There's a balance. But within that uncertainty, I have been able to kind of ease into this year in a great way and be, like you said, more intentional about carving out those times and those breaks. Whether I will be able to sustain those, I don't know, but I am planning, and I think that's a great first step.
Yeah, absolutely. You speak a lot about intentions and goals. How do you set those for yourself? And is it something like a box ticking process at the end to make sure you've achieved them all? What does it look like for you?
It's literally that. The end of the year is the end of the year is so exciting to me because it's an opportunity to reflect, like so many of us do, about what we set out to do and what we actually accomplished. And I always have a physical representation of that through journals. And the beginning of the year, January 1st in particular, is my favorite time because like the possibilities are endless in terms of what you can do and what you can dream to do. And like I'm very practical in so many ways, but I also allow myself to dream and write those things down of what I want to accomplish. And so I am an active journaler and a to-do list person. And these journals also represent, like I have a beginning of the year journal and then usually fill that up. And then around the time of mid-year where I'm able to just keep myself accountable about like now it's June, July. Have you been, are you set on your journey and your goals? And so that like that mid-year check-in is essential and keeps me on track. But I'm very ritualistic about what I set out to accomplish. Mm-hmm.
I have to ask personally for myself, though, because I'm a writer and a journalist, but I've never sat down to journal and nothing gives me more writer's block than like writing about, I don't know, I don't even know where to begin. So give me some tips on journaling. Or is it just a free flow?
It's such a free flow. It's literally what's on my mind. I only recently started therapy. So it's been, you know, like a therapeutic process. Yeah. I tell it, you know, my fears, my secrets, but it literally starts with what's on my mind today. And it could be as simple as like, ugh, I feel yucky and where that takes me, or, oh, I'm set to have a great day today, or, oh, I was thinking about this person. I wonder what they're having. But it's literally like anything that comes to mind and mm-hmm. letting myself feel, which I don't tend to do at all. And you can relate. And then even conversations that I have with friends who I love, you know, sometimes it just doesn't get there. You know, mm-hmm. you don't want to either redirect a conversation or bog people down or so it just allows me a free area to be fully transparent with myself.
Mm-hmm. And sorry, last question on journaling, because now I'm hooked on it. How often are we reading back the journals, and do you cringe or is it bearable?
I'll read it maybe at the end of the year to just be like, what was I going through in the beginning yeah. of January and how has that differed now? I just recently did that, but some of the stuff I'm just like, I don't want to relive this. I've moved on, and it's more just yeah. like a cathartic vomiting of feelings or yeah. thoughts than anything.
Okay, I might put pen to paper. You should. I'm not going to write with a pen and paper. I might do it on my notes in the car
really?
Home. I'll do it on my phone.
Yeah, I'm a big person. I'm like, pen to paper. Do you also, like, as a journalist, do you write pen to paper or do you only write, like, type?
Mostly typing.
Wow.
But maybe I need to, like, get a quill and some ink out and just go old school.
I think that there's magic in, and there is something very physical about, like, actual yeah. pen to paper. It forces you, mm-hmm. like, you're literally in touch with your body and your mind exactly. and your thoughts. And I think that there's something special about that that just allows you to freely flow. Whereas typing almost feels like there's a separation.
Yeah.
Exactly. Try it.
I'm going to. Actually, that's my promise to you. So I'm going to try it for sure.
All right. Great. I'm going to follow up mid-year.
Please do. You spoke in our cover interview as well about wanting to transition towards service over the next decade. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means? And we hope that doesn't mean giving up all of your other pursuits.
I don't think it means giving up all of my other pursuits, because I know that sometimes, especially in this country, it takes money to move the needle. And so to be able to come from a position of privilege to enact change is necessary. It sucks. But for me, that's also where I'm like, oh, all of this is to help mm-hmm. and give back. Mm-hmm. And I can be in a position. It's one thing to help and give back within an industry that, to be honest, there are so many superficial elements. And it is, sometimes you can take a step back and be like, what did I do all this for? Who is it actually physically helping? I think, you know, mentally, people can look towards a film and be like, that might have saved me from a moment. And, you know, or I guess, you know, on the production side, this gave me a job that I really wanted. But when you're taking a step back and especially seeing around me all of society's ills and all of the neglected people, I question, like, what I'm doing to help that. And so I think about that within my own community and my neighborhood. And I also, you know, it's something I've always known that I've wanted to give back and help, I think, even just structurally to make a change. But, like, I'm actively working to do that.
Well, that sounds incredibly purpose-driven. But gosh, you say you want to do more, but you already do a heck of a lot. And you, you write, you produce, you act, you have Hooray, you have other brands. How do you juggle all of those different spinning plates? And it's not like you're doing them all mediocre, like you're smashing mm-hmm. it all. How do you do that?
Well, thank you. Working with great people, like, you know, that is definitely a part of being able to touch so much, is just these collaborations and that trust in knowing that I've hired or I've partnered with or invested in the right people, because I can't do everything. I always give the example of really wanting a coffee shop. Back since 2011, I wanted a coffee shop. And then I met this business manager who's my business manager now. You know, when I had nothing, I was like, why do you want to be my business manager? I don't have no business or money. And he was like, you know, I just believe in you and I want to help you grow. Like, what are your dreams? And I was like, in addition to this entertainment thing, like, I really want a coffee shop. And he was like, I'm going to help you get that. And so when I started getting, like, more opportunities and even money, like, I got a book deal and I was like, yo, I got a little change. Like, I really want this coffee shop. What's up? And he was like, I'm working on it. And then Insecure popped out and I was like, where the fuck is my, like, I want to do this. Let's do this. And he was like, sis, who's going to grind the beans? And I was like, oh, not me. And he was like, yes, I'm trying to find you, like, collaborative mm-hmm. partners to be able to make this happen. And he did that. And so amazing. Now, you know, we have these Hilltop coffee shops. I have these incredible partners. And, you know, I'm able to contribute whatever they need and whatever my value is, and they're contributing their expertise. And that has been like so much of the model of the different collaborations that I have. Like, I'm not going to grind the beans, but I can contribute my value to take this off the ground.
Why a coffee shop? That's a very specific desire to have had.
Because it's where I did all of my work, and I would always have to leave my neighborhood. And that was a specificity, but I wanted a coffee shop in my neighborhood. I wanted a coffee shop in South LA, specifically that serviced Black people. I'm like, we always have to leave. I would have to go to West Hollywood or north of the 10 to LA speak, but just to be able to like go work somewhere. And I got tired of that. I was like, Black people drink coffee too, and we love to work in coffee shops. And Starbucks as a chain, there also weren't, that was a sign of gentrification. And like, my neighborhood hadn't been gentrified in that way yet. And I was like, it'd still be nice to have like a Black owned coffee shop in a Black neighborhood. So for me, that was part of it. And there's also such a, I foster such collaboration. Like, seeing other people work is inspiring. You might have a conversation with someone, and that might lead to your next project. And it's just such a great environment to facilitate creativity.
Totally. Yeah. I love, like, when I don't go into the office working from my coffee shop, and even if I don't actually talk to anyone, I'm eavesdropping all of the different dramas
going
on.
Absolutely. What?
It's just such a fun,
that
buzzing environment.
That is also the best part. Yes, you nailed it.
Well, gosh, we've spoken about so, so much. It's been such a wonderful conversation, or at least I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
But me too.
My last question is, who are the incredible women inspiring you most in 2024?
I think, you know, Quinta and Io, I look at them and I'm just like, you go, Black girls, you go, Black women. Especially with someone like Io, who's in her 20s, and you, like, I can picture what her future can look like and the opportunities that she may have that so many other Black women may not have had the chance to do. So many iconic Black women. So I'm just like, run, be, yeah, do everything. Do everything you want to do, obviously. I work with incredible women internally, so I'm selfish in that way. But I have to shout out, like, just even, you know, my personal team members who I watch dominate and be ambitious and do and say they're going to do something and actively do it and follow through. So they inspire me. I'm a fan of so many people. Beyoncé always inspires me. Victoria Monet, I love that she's, you know, being recognized for working so hard behind the scenes to having her own, like, iconic moment. I'm constantly finding inspiration in Black women.
Mm. Well, you are such an incredible inspiration, and it's been such a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much for being part of our podcast.
Thank you so, so much for having me. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, yay.
The Powerhouses was brought to you by Net-a-Porter and Chalk and Blade, hosted by Net-a-Porter's content director, Alice Casely-Hayford, and fashion director, Kay Barron. The team at Net-a-Porter was Katie Berrington as the senior editor, with casting by Annabelle Brog and Olivia Wakefield, and coordination by Gabriella Pereira. The producer at Chalk and Blade was Laura Hyde, with help from Emily Wally. Original music by Alexis Adamora, and the series was mixed by Nasson da Silva. To make sure you hear all the episodes in this series, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information, go to net-a-porter.com.